Chapter 8. John in the engine room. As Anuxia spoke into the microphone, John saw that many silver-suited people came streaming out onto the main deck. Some came from directly below the balcony where they were, and others from a pair of doorways under the balcony opposite. They came in ones and twos and in small groups, without undue haste, but very soon there were 50 or so people moving across the main deck, taking up operational positions. There were many of the smooth cylindrical columns, and close by the foot of each of them were one or two white rectangular cabinets, in appearance somewhat like a domestic refrigerator. Each cabinet was about 3 feet high, and about 2 feet square on plan. The people seemed to be looking at something near the top of one face of each cabinet. The nearest was some distance away, but he could just make out a darker rectangle, some kind of instrument. Later he saw these close at hand. Some of the people moved around from one cabinet to another, with something in their hands with which they appeared to be making notes. Probably it was the usual handheld instrument, with which we became familiar, looking very like a small pocket calculator, black with red buttons. As this was happening, John's eyes were caught by a new movement overhead. He realized now that what was supported by the columns was not the ceiling, but an intermediate deck, at a higher level than the balconies, which filled a circle of smaller diameter than that which included the balcony ramp system, so that if he looked upwards, he could see right through to the ceiling. In this annular space above him, he could see a succession of bright silvery cylinders which traveled round in a circular path, at first slowly, but with rapidly increasing speed. Each cylinder was attached to a radial arm, which came from the direction of the unseen center of the ship. Soon he realized that there was just one long beam, pivoted centrally somewhere out of his sight, with a cylinder at either end. Each cylinder was shaped, if one can imagine such a thing, like a double-ended bullet. The middle part was cylindrical, but each end tapered off into a streamlined paraboloidal nose. Anuxia now turned to John, and, seeing him looking at the bright cylinders on their rotor beam, they were now turning much faster, said, "If we turn fast enough, there is no gravity to hold us down to the earth." He went on to explain that he had been telling the people to get ready to raise the ship off the ground, because someone was coming, and they had to move to avoid discovery. Under hypnosis, John said, "He has told me that someone is coming, not to be alarmed, someone is coming, they must move on before they are seen. When they stay on the ground, it is danger to them, they must move. They are frightened of being captured. They want to go." A humming sound, quiet at first, coming from below the main deck, increased steadily in pitch and volume, until it reached a fairly noisy maximum, but the giant rotor continued to increase its speed until the separate repetitions of the passing cylinders could no longer be distinguished, and the whole visible part of the rotor became a uniform, gleaming silvery disc. John says the engines made a lot of noise, and he could feel the deck vibrating under his feet. At this point, he had a curious experience. He became weightless, and lost his balance, falling helplessly sideways, but not falling to the deck. He said under hypnosis, "It's like falling into water." Anuxia burst out laughing at this, just as a sailor may be amused at the efforts of a landsman to keep his feet in a rough sea. But he grabbed hold of John, and set him on his feet again. No doubt the joke was an old and familiar one. We may recall that Francis had a similar experience while walking along a corridor after her talk with Uxiolia, but an analysis of the timing of the whole visit makes it doubtful whether these can have referred to the same lifting of the ship. It seems that this civilization had not yet developed gravitation-neutral systems as others had, the Erisive. But also the Ummos had still those indolence problems in their ships, according to the material in the book UFO Contact from Ummo. R.O.REM. Francis, as well as her medical, had spent a long period with Uxiolia, talking and watching films, before he was called away to move the ship, whereas John had just finished his medical, and his two very prolonged visits, one to the engine room and one to the navigating bridge, were yet to come when he felt the ship rise. It seems that the ship moved twice to avoid discovery. He could now feel the entire ship stir, roar, seg, and rise, tilting through an angle as it did so. Anuxia pointed to the thick white soles on his own black shoes, and demonstrated to him that they enabled him to walk securely on the deck. They seemed to cling to the deck, but could easily be lifted clear when he walked. Under hypnosis, John said, I can hear the engines, and I felt the floor vibrating. I felt we were going up very fast, falling over backwards, floating back. Can't stop. He has stopped me there, grabbed hold of me, pulled me back. Jeff, what prevents him from falling? John, he is pointing to his shoes. He is pointing as if to show the thick white soles. It's like foam rubber. He's pointing at them, and putting his foot back on the floor. They seem to stick. He's laughing. Floor dipped, and left side came up. I felt like in a plane, when it banks. Jeff, how long did that feeling last for? John, when I was falling over, it only lasted for about 10 seconds. The floor dipped, not for long, few seconds, then it leveled out. Going back down, landing again. Jeff, how do you know? John, the engine noise, it's dropping. I can hear the rotor going slower. The engines go slower, and it seemed to bounce, went down, popped up slightly. Think we landed, rotors going slower still. Anuxia told John about the big circular room. This is where we make power. He said something about electromagnetism. He said they used very, very high voltage. John understood him to say that the humming sound he heard coming from below was a starting device. Once the rotor was spinning fast enough, it took over. When the crisis was over, and most of the crew had dispersed to their quarters, Anuxia laughed and said to him, you were lucky to be here and see our engine working. Anuxia led John down the ramp, onto the main circular deck. They walked across to look at one of the white cabinets, at the base of a column. He now noticed that a white pipe, of about 5 inches diameter, emerged from the back of each cabinet, low down, and ran up alongside the nearby column, penetrating the perforated rotor deck overhead. Later he was to find that the pipe, which one must suppose to be a heavily insulated cable, connected with a similar cabinet on the rotor deck, directly above. Anuxia opened the hinged side of the cabinet to show him what was inside the casing, but it was not very informative. He could see only a large black rectangular block, with no detail on it, which almost filled the casing, leaving only a small air gap. One may suggest that the black block may contain a condenser, also heavily insulated. Francis was told that static electricity was important in the power system of a spaceship. Plan of upper levels of engine rooms, etc. Near the top of the front of the casing was a recessed instrument shaped like a letterbox, with a linear scale on it. A needle was registering on the scale, about 3/4 of the way across from the left. To John it suggested a voltmeter, and it may well have been just that. Anuxia pointed to the meter, with its needle well over to the right, and said, high power. He went on, when we lift the ship, much power is drained away, and we have to watch that too much is not used. Nevertheless, it seemed odd that so many people should be needed to take separate readings, when the whole thing could easily be handled by a computer. He had a feeling that Anuxia was trying to explain why they needed so many people, but his memory of this is not clear. What we thought ourselves, and it may have been suggested to John, but we cannot be sure of this, is that, because so many people have to be carried in the spaceships, they were really making jobs for people, especially younger men and women who might become bored and restless with spaceship life, to give them something to do, and some experience of an actual planet landing, which must have been exciting for them, after being so long in the ships. They walked round the huge circular deck. At one place, set into the outer wall, was a pair of television-type screens. Below each screen was a broad shelf with some instruments and controls on it, and a seat of the usual one-legged pattern was fixed before each of the two screens. One of the screens was blank, but the other was in action, and a silver-suited technician sat on the black saddle seat, watching the display on the screen, and periodically making adjustments to the controls. The luminous display consisted of 3 vertical lines, extending from top to bottom of the screen. Placed across these lines were a number of short horizontal bars of varying length, one set of bars to each vertical line. The whole display was drifting very slowly downwards. John was told by Anuxia that this instrument had to do with the ship's altitude. Anuxia next took him to a place in the main deck where there was a flight of steps down to a deck below. It was protected by handrails. It is noteworthy that this is the only occasion on which steps or stairs are referred to. I questioned John about this, but he was quite sure that this was, in fact, a fixed flight of steps, rather steep. The lower deck to which the stairs, perhaps we should say companionway, led down, was much less extensive than the main deck, which is what we should expect. It was also of low height. The deck head was about 8 foot 6 inches high. Towards the center of the ship, a bulkhead obstructed his view. This must have been the outer casing of the airlock. Elsewhere, passages led off in different directions. On either side of each passage was a series of huge shapes, each consisting of a big square frame, filling the space available vertically, and about 6 feet in width. Extending horizontally across the middle of each frame was an elliptical cylinder, if geometricians will permit the expression, about 5 feet long, the elliptical cross-section being about 4 foot 6 inches in major, vertical, axis, and about 2 foot 6 inches in minor, horizontal, axis. 1.5 by 0.8 meters, the whole thing was cased in with an off-white smooth material, possibly a plastic as we understand the term, so the internal details could not be seen, but the shape and arrangement strongly suggest a transformer. One must assume the concealed presence of a horizontal member at middle height across the frame, forming a core for the windings. The elliptical shape no doubt allows for better use of the available space, and easier access for maintenance. Again, although the casing did not allow it to be seen, it is reasonable to assume that the whole frame, including the unseen cross member, is laminated in the usual way to discourage eddy currents, and that it forms, as a whole, a core to concentrate the magnetic lines of force. Although he was shown only a part of the lower deck, John understood from Anuxia that it was all the same, and that the deck space was filled with these power units, allowing only the necessary access ways for service. Even if aluminium wire were used for the windings, the total weight would be considerable. It would have the effect of concentrating a large part of the mass of a spaceship into the lowest part of the hull. They returned to the main deck, but John's tour of the ship's power complex was not yet finished. Earlier he had noticed that the numerous columns supported a circular deck, less in diameter than the circle which included the balconies, the deck surface being made up of long panels of perforated metal, about 4 feet wide, arranged radially in a six-rayed pattern. The panels were cut to shape towards the center, so that they all lay in one plane. He presumed there was a structural framework to hold the whole thing together, but could not make it out. Because of the perforations, he could to some extent see through the upper deck from below. He could make out some white cabinets similar to the ones on the main deck, but with an important difference: a great many pipes, mostly thin but some of them very thick, extended from cabinet to cabinet, forming a spaghetti-like maze, so dense that he had been unable to see right through them to the final ceiling above. The thick pipes were similar to those he had seen running vertically, close by the columns, joining the cabinets on the main deck to those on the rotor deck above, but the numerous thin pipes, about an inch in diameter, ran from one cabinet to another on the rotor deck only. There were none on the main deck. When he first looked up through the outer part of the perforated rotor deck, before the cylinders of the rotor began to sweep around, there had been some half dozen or so technicians working up there, but when the rotor began to turn, he had noticed that they left the area in something of a hurry. John had also seen that the perimeter of the upper deck, what we came to think of as the rotor deck, was enclosed by a thick circular wall of a dull gray color. This is noteworthy as one of the few exceptions to the ubiquitous white or silvery surfaces of almost everything in the spaceship. At 6 points, equally spaced round the circle, the gray wall was interrupted by a gap of about the width of a normal doorway, which gave access to the rotor deck itself. Extending radially outward from each of the 6 gaps was a catwalk of the same perforated metal, just a single 4 foot wide strip, bridging the space between the wall gap and a doorway in the outer wall. To be more precise, although he did not realize it at the time, a design analysis shows that four of the six catwalks extended right out to the outer wall of the engine room, but two of them, forming an opposite pair, ran across to meet the somewhat nearer wall segments behind the balconies. Anuxia now took John back up the moving ramp to the balcony again. They passed through a doorway in the back of the balcony, and he found himself back in the dark lift. This time they floated upwards, not very far, and they came out on the same wall that was behind the balcony, but higher up, still within the great circular room. Now they were on a level with the rotor deck, and Anuxia walked out without hesitation along the catwalk, although it had no handrail, and there was nothing to stop one from falling to the main deck, some 20 feet below. John followed Anuxia along the catwalk to the gap in the grey wall, which they passed through onto the rotor deck itself, with its white cabinets and the maze of white piping connecting them. The piping was low down near the perforated deck, and now he realized that the cabinets were lower than those on the main deck, being only about 2 feet high, though their other measurements were similar. The giant rotor was now still, and he was able to examine it closely. In fact, Anuxia told him, no one was allowed to be on this deck while the rotor was turning, it was too dangerous. The beam which carried the bright cylinders on its outer ends was well above John's head, its lower face was nearly 8 feet clear above the deck on which he stood. The beam was 16 inches wide, its edges were rounded, and the upper surface sloped gently up towards the middle from each side. This sectional shape would give some stiffness without impairing the transverse streamlining, so important when the rotor is turning at really high speeds. It would, I think, also give a slight aerodynamic lift to the rotating rotor beam, which was about 36 feet, 11 meters in overall length. At each end, the beam was inserted laterally, insertion, into the center of the cylinder. Each cylinder was about 5 feet, 1.5 meters, long, and about 18 inches, 0.46 meters, in diameter in the middle straight-sided portion. This cylindrical portion was about 27 inches, 70 centimeters, long. Beyond that, the shape smoothly tapered off like a blunt-nosed bullet, with well-rounded ends, not pointed. Spis, the maze, labyrinth, of pipework made it difficult to approach the center of the rotor deck, but John could see plainly the central pivot about which the rotor beam turned. It consisted of a vertical shaft, about 18 to 20 inches minus 50 centimeters in thickness, extending from floor to ceiling, being secured top and bottom in a massive bearing. A comparably massive collar flinscridge, mounted on the shaft near its upper bearing, provided secure anchorage for the beam. My calculations suggest that this collar occupies the geometrical center of the ship. The ultimate ceiling of the engine room was about 10 feet minus 3 meters above the rotor deck, so the overall height of the engine room was about 30 feet 9 meters. The thick gray wall, through which they passed, was about 6 feet minus 1.8 meters high. It did not extend all the way to the ceiling. Anuxia told John that the gray wall was not merely a wall, but it was part of the electrical mechanism. Possibly it is a great circular magnet, but this is my own idea. It was not reported by John. This ended John's conducted tour of the engine room or power complex of the ship. We calculated that it must occupy more than half the total volume of the spaceship, within a circle 150 feet minus 50 meters in diameter. Above it, we thought, there must be three decks, probably not more, containing the smaller rooms, some of which our witnesses have spent some time in, though we did not find it possible to assign precise locations to them. There must be living space for upwards of 50 people, as well as all the remaining stores and technical facilities. One of these latter, the navigation room or bridge as we might call it, John was next to visit. Link to next part, janos2f.html main page.